the weather weenies, dorks, dweebs, nerds all come together to talk weather every Monday night. This is Weather Brains episode number 375 for April Fool's Day. This is April 1, 2013. And I wonder who among this cast is going to be the first to crack a lame April Fool's joke. Not me. I don't do them. I don't like them. I have not done them in years, and I refuse to stoop that low. Brian Peters, do you do? Yes?
I was just going to say that nothing makes me smile more than the muscles in my face.
I don't know what it is. I think this show is either going to be the best or the worst we've ever done based on the pre-show. I don't know which direction we're going, but it's going to be good.
We've already got 10 show titles?
Yeah, that's right. We've got 10 show titles already, and that's all in the pre-show. And by the way, for those that are listening on the podcast version, the produced version, or, maybe you're just kind of joining us on the YouTube thing live, we typically start about 15 minutes before showtime. That's called the pre-show, and that's where all the foolishness goes on here. That's when we get people online, get the guests on, and whenever we say something outrageous, more than not, it's going to be in the pre-show. Brian Peters, are you going to say anything outrageous tonight?
Absolutely not.
Oh, come on.
No. I've turned over a new leaf.
I like it when you get... Well, don't worry. We'll get him cranky before the show is over.
No, not
Brian
this.
Peters is the internationally beloved meteorologist.
Yes.
And Brian worked for the National Weather Service, fine government employee. Now he sits back making that massive pension off the taxpayers' backs and living high on the hog. And he works in the private sector. I mean, the guy is raking in dough from all sides of the weather enterprise. And he does consulting work on top of everything else.
And I just formed a new company.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And that is called what?
Weather Events LLC.
Ooh. Ooh.
And what does Weather Events LLC purport to provide? What service do you sell?
According to the paperwork filed with the state of Alabama Department of Revenue, anything and everything related to weather.
Well, that's broad. That's helpful.
Make the announcement, Brian.
No, I'm not ready to make the announcement.
Come on.
No, I'm not ready to make the announcement. You just be patient, Kevin. Please.
Why would I be patient?
Well, because I have the first picture for the future announcement.
Oh, okay.
And it's yours.
What are you guys talking about? Is this an inside joke? I'm not even in
I'm
on
just
this.
Trying
what
to get, I'm just trying
about?
To inch him along, to encourage him along.
Oh, don't give me that, James. You're in on this.
In on what?
Okay. All right.
Oh, he's going to announce it.
You drug it out.
Two people who know all about it want me to say something about it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm working.
What will do? Is this breaking news? Well, wait a minute.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Go.
I'm working on an iBook entitled Weather Brains 101.
Yay!
Do you know how many people have requested this? I mean, this
no,
is like
how, who's requested this? I haven't heard anything like that. You get all these emails.
I did.
Well, on a regular basis, we get people that, and you've done some really cool segments. And for those that are new, every week Brian does a segment called Weather Brains 101. And it's about really good science facts and information that you can actually use as opposed to most of the stuff on here that's hogwash. And so people have suggested that we take Brian's segments. And this is show number 375. We've been doing this for a long time and put them all together. So Brian is working on that. So how's it coming?
Yeah, it's actually slow.
After we played the breaking news, now it's
honest.
Slow.
Well, you know, James, it's slow because, I mean, I have all the audio and I have all the text files. It's slow because I'm trying to learn new software and how to prepare an iBook. And I know there's easy programs out there, but you still have to learn something about them. So I'm in the process of learning.
So you say an iBook, and maybe I just don't understand how it's consumed. So this is like a book instead of the audio? Are you translating all this stuff?
iBook includes all kinds of things, including
multimedia.
Audio. It's multimedia.
It'll be for the iPad. You can listen to the audio and have the text of each.
So when he gets done with this, the rest of us here on this here program are finally going to get something for all of our time because I expect a free copy.
I promise you'll get a free copy if I can work it out. But
can you autograph it for me?
Of course. As Kevin can attest, there are some ins and outs that make it a little slow. For example, I have to get an ISBN number.
An ISBN number? Isn't that like a PIN number? Doesn't the N stand for number?
Well, I don't know. It's international something, 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 but it's a number for the book. And you have to apply to, yeah, but anyway, so that'll be,
this is good.
Comments.
We want people to rush in and buy this book when it's available, and we'll break the news here when it's ready to go. I'll be the first customer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I will be customer number one. Nate, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a Pepsi that I acquired the other day, and this is a special Pepsi for two reasons. Number one, let me put that. It's a glass bottle. You know, I can't get those. And number two, none of that high fructose corn syrup. This has got the real deal in it. C6H12O6. Sugar in there. Wow. Let's do a science, kids. Yeah.
I love those additives.
Wow.
Anyway.
Well,
so
what can you say? I mean, we are on a riveting start here. You don't hear talent like that just anywhere.
Yeah, that brought the show to a grinding halt.
Nate, guess who I talked to on the phone? Friday.
I bet you had a conversation with my general manager, Stephen D. Hamill.
I sure did.
And please tell me that my name did not come up, because if it did, I am toast.
You're toast.
We mentioned your name, but not in association with this show.
Thank
so
God.
You're safe.
Thank God.
There you go. I am protective of those that are on this show. Now, Steve and I used to work together years ago. We worked together 30 years ago in Dallas, Fort Worth. We were both in our 20s. And, you know, loved every minute of it, but we were young, and he's a great guy, and I appreciate our friendship, and it was good to talk with him. So, but let's move on here. We got a lot of folks on the line here. Kevin, you've got some big storms out to the west of you tonight.
Yeah, they're trying to hold together. They're not having much luck north of Abilene, but big cluster went south of Childress and west of Wichita Falls, and we'll see. I don't think they're going to have too much, but it could be an active couple of days. We're looking for some heavy rain in parts of Texas through the middle part of the week.
And that critter in Haskell County looks like it's getting ready to intersect some sort of boundary that's a line perpendicular with its motion. That could be fun here in a little while.
I think that thing's producing a Toyota-sized hail right
now. Yeah.
I mean, look at that's like almost 70 dBZ I'm showing on my reflectivity here. So,
yeah,
but Kevin, you got a guest you want to bring in here.
I do, yeah. We're going to have a guest weather brain today, also from Texas, in Waco, Texas, Conley Isom from KXXV. Conley, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Conley got my attention because he always reads the Digital Meteorologist blog and makes comments on it. That's the only reason he's here. No, he's a good guy and a thoughtful guy. And Conley, jump in. We're going to have a good discussion with our guest tonight. We're going to have really interesting information. And thanks for joining us, and jump in anytime you want.
Hey, forget all that, Conley. What kind of mic have you got there?
It's actually one that we had laying around the TV station that we haven't used in years. So I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but it works.
It kind of looks like a lightsaber or something there. It's cool looking.
I've got it on a microphone stand right now. So
okay, that's cool. All
thanks.
Right, awesome,
James.
Yes.
I have a solution for your problem. You were so worked up about sirens last week.
Yes, I was.
Those who missed the program, James went on like two fairly long rants about sirens, and I got thinking
about
it.
That's like every week.
No, this was unique for James. I mean, James was pretty far out there, and he's saying you're never going to hear the sirens. You're never going to hear the sirens. Don't rely on them. So I've solved the problem. If we can put this through, this is what you will hear when the sirens blow in your area for tornado warning.
Now,
is this the audio you sent me?
Yeah, you missed the cue, James. That's awful.
Kevin was saying, should I
set it up again?
Another show title.
You see, we are on a rip-roaring start here.
I am so sorry.
Here's the audio you will hear from a tornado warning if this goes through.
Hang on.
Oh, man.
I've blown up the soundboard.
You always have that thing ready.
You had me so panicked. I almost always do.
You always do.
So hang on.
Now we got to go back and start the whole show again.
Yeah, we got to start the whole show and from scratch. All right. What we're going to do is redo this, and we're going to play Kevin's audio. And just like magic, you're going to hear it right now.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Kapuya, kapuya. Nice. Very nice. I'm thinking...
That is so good. We got to play that one more time.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Kapuya, kapuya. Kapuya, kapuya.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Nobody got time for that.
I can't wait to hear from Laura. I think this is the solution to all the social impact stuff that she's been working on. So we'll go ahead and ask her about that when we have a chance.
Yeah, we're going to get the hail lady to go on the sirens, and that will make it all work.
Okay.
But let's see. Bill Murray, you've got to bring in our special guest before she hangs up on us. I can't believe she's sat through all this foolishness so far.
Well, she's actually busily taking notes over there, James, because you just you saw the whole problem there, Kevin. That'll fix it all. Tonight's guest, Weather Brain, is no stranger to the Weather Brain's crew. She's a friend of the podcast, a leading social scientist. She's made a name for herself in the weather world. She's a research professor with the Social Science Research Center at Mississippi State and the University of Alabama Center for Advanced Public Safety. Dr. Laura Myers, welcome back to the show.
Hey, everybody.
Well, we're glad to have you. Laura, lots happened since we met you in 2011. Of course, how did you get tied up into all that weather stuff back in 11? Or was it before that?
It was in 11. I had arrived in Mississippi prior to the 2011 severe storm season and was doing work in emergency management. And there was a strong component of weather research involved with that. And then when the storm season of 2011 hit, I connected with several folks in the Weather Enterprise in Alabama and Mississippi and started using the research work I was doing to support the efforts of people who wanted to know more about human behavior and severe weather events.
Well, now you studied a lot of data since then, and of course you've been working with a couple of weather service offices here in the South. And so tell us, you know, is there anything that you've taken away as an early finding from any of your research that you think stands out?
Well, it's been real interesting to really focus on how people receive weather warnings and really bisect the weather population, so to speak. We've got people who are very weather savvy and they seek weather information and they have emergency plans. And then there's a significant percentage of the population who are not as weather savvy for various reasons. They either don't know how to get the weather information or they don't seek the weather information. And if they can get the weather information, they don't know what to do with it. And so it's been real interesting to explore that part of the population and try to understand what we can do better to reach that population and get information to them.
You know, James was on his rant about sirens, and that's one of our favorite things to talk about here. But have you seen anything that's contrary to what we believe in, or any takeaways that indicate to you that those sirens are important?
Well, there's a big difference of opinion, and I'm very familiar with James's perspective on it and have listened to discussions of various groups and stakeholders that have an interest in the warning process. And if you talk to emergency managers, they'll tell you that the sirens are important, and they talk about it from the perspective of what the siren is intended for. It's an outdoor warning. And so many emergency managers want to see the sirens still being utilized. But then when we talk about the majority of the population, they assume that they're going to hear it no matter where they're at. So James is right on target with the problem. It's the perception that the siren is a major warning and that you're going to hear it and that you're going to be able to react to it. So I think it has to be a supplement, a complement to all of the other warning processes that we have, all the other modalities that we have. But the problem is the education of the public. They need to understand that the sirens are not the primary method of getting the warning.
And let me say this too, you know, because of Laura's work, you know, for a while I was saying, let's just take the darn thing down, the things down and burn them. That way, you know, you won't hear them. But after her work, and again, I've said this over and over, it doesn't matter what I think. It really doesn't. And it doesn't matter what anybody on this show thinks. It matters what Joe Q Public thinks. And she is the only person on this show really qualified to go out there and tell us what Joe Q Public thinks. And I know that they serve a purpose now. They reach a limited number of people outdoors. And if they do that, fine. Let's leave them up. And you're right. We have to do a better job of educating people. But I get so discouraged, Laura, even to this day, and it's been almost 2 years after April 27, 2011, that people still think you're supposed to hear them. And these are intelligent, well-to-do people that should know better. It's just like there are days I feel like I'm banging my head against the wall on this issue.
Yeah, and I think it's a big deal. I think, you know, we spend a lot of time on the education. You guys do it through the broadcast media. The information is out there. We hear it. We understand it. And the question is, how do we connect it to the public? Because like you're saying, as much as we push that information out there, it seems people are still reliant on what I call the myths of weather warnings. They're tied into what they've always believed and what they always think. And so it's really hard. I think the biggest thing is to keep the kind of the grassroots effort going at education. All the activities that you guys do in the community where you get out, you talk about the NOAA weather radios and what to do with them and all the different warning modalities that can be used. I think a bigger part of that is getting people to understand what the warning means to them and what they need to do. I think that's an even bigger part of it. I think people think, you know, different things about watches and warnings. They don't understand the different types of severe storm events. They don't understand the differences between things like a severe thunderstorm. They don't understand straight line winds. They don't understand the differences between straight line winds and tornadoes. And so a lot of times they're just assuming that it's not going to be that bad. They don't have to worry about it. So we really need to do more at the grassroots level to get that education out there.
Laura, how much of your research and your questioning dealt with, you know, the understanding of the storm-based warnings and the polygons, as you know, as we fondly call them? You know, what does the public tell you about their understanding of these, you know, very precise, very specialized warnings that the Weather Service puts out, but we have a hard time getting in the hands of the public?
Well, what was interesting at the beginning of kind of the research process back in 2011, there wasn't a lot of understanding about the polygon. In fact, people didn't even know what a polygon was. In fact, a lot of the broadcast media folks were saying they would call it something other than a polygon to try to educate the public. They would call it a block or a rectangle or something different to try to convey that information. But what I've seen since 2011 is a much better understanding by the public of what the polygons are and the fact that it really gives much more precise information to the recipient of that information. So I've seen an evolution in a very short period of time of the public's understanding of what the polygon means. And I think the fact that it, you know, really gives them more of the specificity, the confirmation, the location, path, and proximity is a big deal to the public.
You said an important word there, and that's confirmation. It seems that the public generally has to seek that confirmation before they'll take action. Is that what you found? And how do we shorten that cycle so that there's not so much reliance on that process?
Well, they need multiple modalities of getting the warning information. And that's one of the things we've been working really hard with emergency managers on, because, you know, the Weather Service provides the warning information. The broadcast meteorologists are pushing that information out to the public. And so the question is once the public receives that information, what's the delay time between when the warning was issued, when they get it, and then when they get that confirmation? They're going to go through a process. And so what we need to do is we need to shorten all of those times, which means we need multiple modalities. If they're getting it through the television, if they're getting it through the sirens, if they're getting it through the smartphone apps, they're going to need to get it from at least two, if not three, sources before they really start to take it to heart. And for many people, that secondary confirmation is going to come from that TV meteorologist. The trust that they have in that meteorologist, they're going to turn to the television to get that information or to the radio to get that information. So we've just got to make sure that we're blasting that information from every possible source, including things like social media. I think social media has a much better chance of shortening that secondary confirmation time.
I have a question for you. I want to ask you, though, because I think the key to that, if you're going to throw multiple modalities, and I agree with that, I've done my master's thesis is right up this alley. I've spent the last week head buried in this. So one of the things that I've found is that people need to have that confirmation. The problem is when they expect to get it, i.e. from a siren, and don't, or they flip channels and it's on one station, but it's not another. Or they hear all about it. They see they hear the sirens, whatever, but it's not dark outside their house. And so they want to go look for it. Is there a way that we can, you know, not only shorten the time with each one of those steps in the process, or, you know, somehow try and make it so that the process doesn't rely on everything being lockstep? Because it seems like if there's anything, any source of confusion, people want to read their optimism bias into that and go, well, it's on channel 5, but it's not on channel 11, so it must not be affecting me.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. The psychology of it is exactly what you're talking about. They want to assume that, you know, optimistically it's not going to happen to them. So if there's any positive in that process, such as not seeing a dark sky, they're going to lean in that direction. And so what we've got to do is make sure that we're getting that secondary confirmation to them. Because I've heard James a lot of times on the TV say, you may not be seeing this, but it's there. And so he'll, you know, really talk about what they might be seeing versus what the reality is, telling them how close it is to them, where it's going to be, what it's going to be. And that's where the impact-based warnings come in. When you can start to talk about what this event will do, I think that starts to make people think a little bit more than I have to actually see it coming. If it's going to be really dangerous and cause a high impact, then maybe I better take action regardless of whether I can see it or not.
Does the weather science have the kind of skill to be able to do the impact-based warnings in a way that allows us to be credible?
Well, there's a big debate about that. There's several projects going on right now on impact-based warnings, and the question is whether or not the science, you know, really corresponds to that. Because the problem with that is when you start giving impact-based warnings and then that event doesn't occur in a specific location, it's going to be considered a false alarm. And so then you've got the cynicism that starts to develop about, well, we were warned that this is what was going to happen, it didn't happen. But then the converse of that is, well, maybe it went someplace else, but it did do that kind of damage. And so there's some people who say we shouldn't go in that direction until we can be more precise. Others are saying we'd rather err in that direction of saying this is what really could happen.
Laura, is this business about having multiple modalities? Is this just human nature that people are not going to necessarily 100% trust the first time they hear these things? I'm confused by that. I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear your thought.
They are. None of us take the first thing we hear as is the truth. We want additional information about just about anything that we're thinking about. And that's the psychology of the human. And so we're going to want to get it from multiple sources. We don't trust the first source. We're going to go to who we do trust or what we trust. And that's another part of educating the public. We've got to develop that trust before the event happens. That's why our TV meteorologists are so important, because they've developed trust and rapport with the community. Certain smartphone apps are going to establish credibility. Twitter is starting to establish credibility. So, for example, when I'm in the middle of a severe storm event, I'm going to check multiple modalities, and I'm going to check two or three of my trusted sources, and I'm going to see, you know, if I can find the consistency. And that goes to Nate's comment about, you know, how do we, you know, get that confirmation? That first thing I see, I'm not going to necessarily trust until I see it from the second or third.
The Twitter thing really concerns me, and it goes back to the town meeting they had after the April event there. As just one example, I heard a woman who came to the town meeting, and she got up and she had the microphone, and she said, well, when I heard there were tornadoes, I started searching around on Twitter. And that bothers me every day, because it concerns me that she's fumbling around on Twitter looking for information amongst the tweets from her nephew who's eating cheese, in addition to looking for credible weather information.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of work to be done with social media and the weather warning process. For example, my Twitter is set so that everybody I'm following is weather related. So when I look at my Twitter, I'm looking at weather information. And I don't think people really realize the importance of setting up your Twitter feed to get the information that you're looking for. Otherwise, you're right. You're digging through a bunch of information. And so it's really how we bring those sources of information to ourselves.
Well, do you have any information on the number of people who are savvy enough on Twitter to do that? I was listening to an interview with one of the early guys that funded Twitter, and he was saying, and this was just a recent interview, you know, there's been all this talk about the various clients that you use for Twitter, but he said the client traffic only amounts to maybe 5 to almost 10%, which suggests that a lot of people are using it via the web interface and just a straight feed, which is part of my concern.
Right. And that gets, again, to the weather savvy versus the non-weather savvy. I think it goes to how do we educate the public to use social media in a way that will help them do the things they want to do, not just weather information, but other sources of information. So I think from the weather enterprise perspective, it goes again to how do we educate the public to use social media in a way that helps. And I can tell you, emergency management has the same problem. They're trying to figure it out. How do they push information out through social media?
Right. Well, what's the solution to James's problem? He has a lot of people on Facebook, but because those people don't interact with his posts on a regular basis, they get pushed to the background by the edge rank algorithm, and they're never going to see them. Are we supposed to educate people that they need to like all of his comments or something?
It's the siren problem all over again. They expect to get the warnings via sirens, but don't get them, and that introduces that little bit of, well, maybe I didn't hear it as bad as I thought it was.
Right. And that goes again to, you know, really working with whatever sources of information you're using during regular events. It's like, I know how to use Twitter and Facebook during an event because I follow James all the time through all of those events. And everybody does that to some degree with their television stations and their broadcast meteorologists. They all have some kind of a relationship, whether it's through social media, through television, through whatever ways they're getting their warning mechanisms. And so it's a matter of how do we educate the people over time to start to rely on that information so that they're really getting it on the forefront and utilizing it properly and trusting it.
Would it be fair to say to use the social media platforms as a promotional tool and to encourage information providers to drive people to a more consistent authoritative source rather than staying in those environments?
That's probably the safest for now until, you know, the public becomes more savvy with the use of social media. I think we don't have enough research on how people use social media and how they need to use it more effectively. And I think, you know, before that happens, I think that's what first responders, emergency managers, public officials are doing. They're trying to drive that information in a way that it tells them how to get what they need.
But broadcasters are doing it. Certain exceptions obviously arise, but broadcasters are just trying to increase their follower count and promote themselves.
Well, in a way, but, you know, I think it's really important when we start trusting those sources, when that information is going out and I'm seeing that information, then it's like, okay, well, how helpful is that information? Is it getting me what I need? And like you say, some are doing it for different reasons, but I think those that are trying to educate us are doing it for the right reasons. And I can name all over the country, broadcast meteorologists are doing a really excellent job of this.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can get people to not want to look outside? I mean, it's maybe the pipe dream there, but in the stuff that I've looked at, it seems like people want that a large number of people will simply not be satisfied no matter how many, like the Weather Service assessment in Joplin called them risk signals, until they see it coming.
Yeah, I think that everybody's going to do that. You know, even as much as a weather savvy person's going to get all that information and know they should be underground, they know they should be enacting their safe plan, there's still, you know, so many other psychological factors. One is it really out there, or I want to see it? You know, a lot of people want to see it coming and think they're still going to have time to save themselves. There's that example of the couple that was watching the tornado come toward their front window, and they were so excited about it, and it ended up killing the husband. And, you know, they could have taken, you know, protective action, but they were just so interested in seeing it coming. And that's part of the problem, is there's still that human desire to see the monster. And the biggest thing is to really get them to understand you don't have time. You need to be enacting your safe plan. And it's also important to know there's a certain percentage of people that are overly cautious anyway. They're going to be underground. Some take a lot of risks, and they're going to look for it.
Hey, Laura, following up on that question, how important is it, since people naturally want to look out the window, how important is it for broadcasters, for those of us in the broadcast business, to actually have live video streams of tornadoes on the air during severe weather coverage?
I think it's important. The public talks about it a lot. They, you know, it really helps them understand the gravity of what it is. It makes it more real to them. They begin to understand things about how close it could be to them, what kind of damage can be done. It ramps up the seriousness level. And so, but it's not just the video. It's what you say about it. It's the video. It's the, you know, people calling in and saying what happened, the damage reports. I think all of those things play in.
And along those lines, I'm a big believer in being in front of the green wall and being on camera. A lot of people in our business have retreated during tornado warnings. They go back to the equipment bank and they do the telestrator back there and they work the equipment, but you never see them on camera. Don't you think it's important to be seen where your body language, your eye contact kind of tells the story too? Uh-oh, did we lose? Was that a bad question?
No, you're back.
Yeah, I think okay. I got the question. You were asking about you being, you know, in front of the green screen and the body language and, you know, the whole effect of, you know, conveying the seriousness of it versus, you know, just what the data is saying and the radar and the equipment. And it does make a big difference. The public in all of the surveys and the interviews that we did talk about that. They talk about the tone of voice. They talk about the mannerisms, especially, and this goes back to the earlier questions about how do we capture their attention. Watch their TV meteorologist day after day, and then we get in much more serious. So they can tell the difference. They can hear the concerns you're trying to convey. And a lot of people took action faster, the most extreme actions that they.
They watch the local guy day after day after day, but if you look at the trend, the numbers of people watching day after day after day are going down by the thousands each week.
Yeah, and that's another thing that we have to understand is the differences in TV viewing, and that's where social media comes into play. Younger generations are not watching TV like older generations do. You know, people in their 20s now, you talk to college students, and they hardly ever watch television. So they are not developing any rapport with TV meteorologists, anchor people, you know, the credible sources, so to speak. So then how do we create a credible source in the media that they do receive? And is that through social media? Is that through the internet? So a lot of the same information and a lot of the same processes can be done through the internet. And I know James and other broadcast meteorologists use so many different venues, radio and internet and different sources to get that information out.
Go ahead, Conley.
You talked about having someone in front of a camera, and James was saying in front of the green screen to convey emotion and the tone in your voice. But the problem in our business now is there's so many younger kids. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm that old, but they can't communicate effectively during that. I mean, to me, if you had a young kid who's only been in the business for a couple of years, had a tornado warning, tornado on the ground, and you hear in his voice the shakiness, the uncertainty, because he just doesn't have the experience, I think is going to convey the wrong message. And that's a big problem in our business. TV stations aren't willing to pay the money to have good talent. And in the smaller markets, there's just not a lot of good communicators out there.
Yeah, and I think it's important. A lot of the social scientists I work with in the weather research are communication experts, and they talk about that. And they talk about the ability to communicate, to convey information, and all the different ways we can convey information. And, you know, I'm sure James can talk about this. A lot of these young broadcasters, they'll get a severe storm event early in their careers, and they get experience real fast. And then others don't have any severe events for a long time in their careers and don't have a lot of experience with learning how to do this. And so I think training in communication would be very important for broadcast meteorologists, for anybody that's conveying that information, really understanding what we've learned from the public about the, you know, the different communication factors that are important. And those are simple tools to learn. You know, James has learned it over time through experience. Your seasoned veterans know how to do it. But, you know, how do we teach that to what we call the rookies, the newbies out there that could, you know, learn that information quickly and utilize it effectively?
And the point, to come off that point, Conley, it's interesting because I've seen a lot of really, you know, bigger market broadcasters that are like Chicken Little and the sky is falling and, oh my God, it's the world's coming to an end. I would much rather have a rookie who is approaching the situation. I can hear the shakiness, but they're not going nuts about it. They're just approaching it with the kind of respect that the situation needs. And I've heard probably as much of that as I've heard of, you know, really good, solid broadcasters. And, you know, on the flip side of that, I think there's an element where you might be too good. I don't know of anybody, certainly, you know, not me, I'm not that good, but there's some folks that may be too good in the sense that you can squash all of that emotion out and you don't let any of the humanity sort of bleed through.
I agree with you, Nate, because I think it was the Super Tuesday outbreak. I saw some video coverage, I believe, of a meteorologist in the Memphis area. And what struck me the most, and, you know, I was relatively new to the television business at that time, what struck me the most was he was so calm to the point of being, in my opinion, completely without any emotion about this event. And they've got this live tornado passing through parts of Memphis, Tennessee. And it's like, you know, he was so cold. He was so calm. It was like, well, okay, why should I be worried? There's nothing going on. It seems to
maybe
me,
he was drunk.
Well, I have, but you know, to me, I saw the gravity of the situation, and I certainly did not get that from him. He was so calm, cool, and collected that it just didn't seem like it was even an exciting event.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, our interviews and surveys tell us, is that the public doesn't respond to that. They don't consider that a credible source when they see somebody that's that neutral and that cold. They understand the differences in somebody that conveys it at the right time. And Nate's point is, it can be the rookie, it can be the, you know, seasoned veteran that does it. It's the rapport that they generate and how they, you know, convey that at different times. With the April 27th, 2011 event, there was a ramping up over time. So for several days, the broadcast meteorologists, to a T, each one of them started getting more and more serious each day, and then the day of the event with each hour. And the public talked about that. And, you know, if a broadcaster can't do that, then they're not going to be a source that people turn to.
Wait, but compare your comment about Brian's comment about this guy, this particular guy, was not excited enough. Take it to the other extreme. If you've got the news departments going crazy over a given event that maybe isn't as big an event, then you're into the cry wolf syndrome.
Yeah, and I think that's a big problem. And, you know, we've actually, in our research, kind of debated that with all the partners in the weather enterprise process, because you've got the emergency managers out there trying to respond to event. You've got the TV producers who are wanting to get all the information about the event and push all that information out there and, you know, really, you know, turn that event into, you know, all the graphic details of what's going on. Then you've got the broadcast meteorologist sitting in the middle of it who's really trying to convey what the actual event is about and what it means and what people should be doing. And there's got to be a balance between the two. So one of the things that we've done is actually done a lot of workshops between the TV production side and the emergency management side to talk about a better balance in conveying that. And that's really hard to do because, you know, it's about the ratings. It's about, you know, the attraction of the public to it. But it is going to lend itself to what you're talking about. It's going to create that cry wolf syndrome.
What? Go ahead. I'm sorry. What form of is that outreach taken to the news departments?
All the way up to the top level. We've done that here in Alabama.
Uh-huh. Because I know there was a news director in this market. He's no longer a news director, but he's around that was...
Oh, let's call some names, well, Kevin.
I probably should, but I might get fired. But he was overheard during an event in Dallas rooting for the tornado because it made better pictures.
Wow.
Oh, brother. Yeah. Please.
Yeah, well, there's a certain jadedness about especially the news side, and I don't want to be there are plenty of weather people that root for the tornadoes too, Kevin. It's not just the GMs, it's not just the news directors. There are plenty of us on this side that have been guilty of going, all right, come on to that storm that's heading out in the middle of nowhere. So I don't think we can be as innocent as you'd like us to be.
Well, that's what I was interested in the outreach and what it was. I think it's fantastic. I'm just curious.
And here's one thing I've seen these news departments do that really drives me crazy. So let's say we've got a big outbreak day. You've got big damage somewhere, all right? Like a Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I've seen some stations where they just go to live news coverage where you've got four tornadoes on the ground. And news took it away from weather because they've got some blow-dried boob that's out there doing a live shot, you know, some pretty boy. And they think it's cool. We got a live shot. We're first on the scene. We're live. We're local. We're late breaking. all this stuff where I've got a tornado emergency. They have no business taking over from the weather department. And that's something that we've got to do better in this in our business. It's deciding in advance, not during an event. Let's all get together, and the weather people have to make the call.
Well, but
the news director is not qualified.
But here's the thing, and I think Dr. Myers will back me up on this. There is something, this goes back to that visual confirmation. Anything that we can do to short circuit the process to keep people from spending time looking out the window and get them moving to the basements, moving to the storm cellar, and if showing them what that tornado has already done, or showing, as you were doing on the 27th and have done since then, showing them the images of what it's done and what it is doing, that is incredibly powerful stuff. And that may, for some people, short circuit that process, get that confirmation step taken care of, and get them moving to the basement.
That's fine, but you can't take over for 5, 10, or 15 minutes. I mean, yeah. And I've seen some markets where they take over for 10 minutes, and I'm not going to name names, but it's in the same market in which Kevin is located, where they took some live reporter with a guy with two shingles off of his roof, two shingles, and then they went to this live reporter for like 5 minutes. We are first on the scene, where you had tornadoes down, and it was a big deal. Yeah. You can't do that. That's just stupid.
Yeah, and all of that is true, and it needs to be more of a balance. And the way that we did it here in Alabama is the Alabama Broadcasters Association and the Alabama Emergency Management Association actually came together to discuss what that proper balance would be. And the emergency managers had the perception of broadcast of television, just like what Nate was saying is that, or what Kevin was saying is that it's, you know, all about the ratings. And then, you know, the broadcasters and the production people were all about, no, it's all about, you know, we want the details and emergency managers won't give it to us and we need that information. And when they got in a room together, it turned out a lot of that was myth, that it was, you know, a few individuals on both ends were the extremes of those spectrums, and there needed to be a better balance. And so they started discussing that. And so now we actually have a continued discussion going on at all of the conferences between emergency management and the Broadcasters Association to do a better job.
Hey, Laura.
Hey, here's a question real quick from the chat room. We took over Bill Murray's interview, didn't we? We're just blowing his interview to smithereens. The chat room folks are wanting to know, are people doing anything different in the case of a tornado warning versus the case of a tornado emergency? Many local weather service offices and broadcast meteorologists are using that term when there is a known tornado that looks large and it's down and it's doing damage. Is there any advantage of using the message tornado emergency versus tornado warning?
Yeah, when we interviewed the public about that, they say it makes a big difference, or it will make a big difference, depending on whether they've experienced receiving a tornado emergency. They understand that it is a bigger event. What we also know, though, is it's not just using the wording tornado emergency, but it's also giving some of that impact-based messaging, talking about the potential damage with the emergency, what the wind speeds might be, what the type of damage might be. So also explaining what emergency means as opposed to just a regular tornado warning.
Hey, Laura, since the last time you were on, and this is one of the reasons I had asked Bill to see if he could come on again, is that James is getting little bits and pieces of information from you about this, and he brings them up kind of here and there on the show. But I'm wanting to know where the rest of us can get it. I mean, he communicates with you. Are you making some big presentation that's going to appear somewhere? Is it coming out in little bits and pieces? How do the rest of us get all this stuff?
Well, we've disseminated it in several different ways. We've done several reports. We did reports from some of the early research. We've got reports that really kind of cover several years of this research. And then there are several presentations that I have done and, you know, continue to do on various aspects of this.
And how do we access those?
I can give you access. That easiest way is email me and I can provide it to you.
Well, can we, is there some,
Kevin, it costs $10,000 for you.
Is there somewhere that not just us on the program or even just listeners, but because I was at a thing here in North Texas a couple of weeks ago. It was the North Central Texas Council of Governments and the Weather Service people were here, and there were a bunch of EMA and first responders, but there were also some school people and local city people and some hospital people. And, you know, they're all fascinated by this kind of stuff. And so if there was some general repository, especially when people come to ask me, and I'm happy to help facilitate that if you want to try that. But I would just like it if it's available to be more readily available without having to, you know, a million people send you an email.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can do that. You know, I can put together everything that, you know, we've done here in Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, as well as access to what is called a much bigger repository, the Weather Ready Nation Initiative. There's a whole series of reports, articles, research results that have been done by multiple researchers just on, you know, these various topics. And so there's a lot of that information that can be obtained as well through the Weather Ready Nation Initiative.
Okay. Well, I'll follow up with you because I know folks here in North Central Texas are interested in it, and then maybe we can talk about a broader thing too, but I'll follow up with you.
Okay.
Laura.
Hey, Laura, we have a problem. I'm sorry, Bill. One more question. I'll be done. We have a problem, I believe, in reaching, in my market, lower income families and Hispanics. What can we do as broadcasters to be better at that?
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the community outreach and determining how to better communicate with those populations in a particular community. Who are the leadership in those communities, in those neighborhoods, and how can you push that information into those communities in a way that it'll be received either because of language differences or cultural differences. So working through church leadership, working through community leadership to try to get, you know, the efforts out that we're doing in broadcast meteorology and the Weather Enterprise, I think is one of the top ways we can do it. And also including those communities and cultures in our weather events and making sure that they're represented in our weather events.
I want to follow up on that, James, because that's excellent. I'm so glad you said that, because you reminded me of a guy that was at this meeting that I was at a couple of weeks ago. He's actually in the political arena. He came up from Austin, and he's assistant to somebody. I don't remember, but I remember his statement so clearly saying, look, in the political arena, when we want to get our message out, we do exactly what you just said. We go to the church leaders and the community and the civic group leaders, because then you've got sort of a core, and it could even be a big group of influential people or influencers who then distribute amongst their little communities. And that's when you're getting back into the social media thing too. So I think that's fascinating, especially when you say it and then the guy from Austin said it.
This is sociology and comm theory 101. I love it.
That was good.
Laura, I know that the Weather Service has invited you along on some service assessments lately, and we think that's a great thing. Are you getting
Except
to have some
stopped.
Real valuable input?
Yeah, and Nate's right. They did stop. Yeah. My first experience was last summer with the Derecho storm assessment that happened back late June, early July. And the goal of having social scientists on the service assessments is to bring the human factor research into the process. What we did in the Derecho event is we went out and actually interviewed people, the public, emergency managers, the broadcast media, everybody that was involved in the process to find out how they got the warnings and, you know, what they did with the information, what worked, what didn't work. And the Derecho event was really interesting because it involved such a large geographic region. We had multiple regions, multiple National Weather Service offices, and different types of events all the way along the lines of that particular storm event. And then there was the next event was the Superstorm Sandy, and I actually created the surveys that were used for that. But that's what Nate's talking about. That's when the social scientists were pulled from that process. And so what NOAA and the National Weather Service are trying to do is figure out a way to reintegrate social science back into that process.
So you don't think this is a permanent decision? This was just a short-term change in what seemed to be a very promising direction we were going?
Yeah, they've been moving in this direction for quite a while, and we've made a lot of inroads in, you know, the collaboration between social science and meteorology, and this was just a kind of an aberration, and so we've come up with some very creative ways to get the social sciences back into the process. It won't be neglected for too long.
I know James has been following your work with the Center for Advanced Public Safety at the University of Alabama, and can you share anything there that you got going on that's going to be promising in the future?
Yeah, the Center for Advanced Public Safety is part of engineering and computer science at the University of Alabama, and they develop technologies for first responders, law enforcement, emergency management, to put technologies in the hands of decision makers. And what they have created previously is the electronic citation system for the state of Alabama and other states. And what that means is every police officer has a computer in their car, and they can obtain information they need to do their jobs. And what we want to do is start putting weather information into those systems so that law enforcement officers and other first responders actually get the weather warning information directly in their car. They can see the polygon. They can use that to guide their tactical decision making, also to help remove themselves from danger. But then we also want to flip it around and use them as trained storm spotters. And what they'll be able to do with this technology is actually pinpoint on a map exactly what they're seeing, and they don't have to be right on top of it, which means they're in danger. They can, you know, see, you know, certain characteristics of a storm event. They can indicate that in this system and pinpoint exactly where it is, and then that information is conveyed back to broadcast meteorologists and the Weather Service.
Well, listen, Laura, you've been on here for an hour. We thank you for taking the time to come on the show again. And again, on behalf of all of us, thanks for your work. And I've said this over and over, you know, there's so much we don't know. We don't understand this. Everybody you see here, we've been trained in engineering and science and meteorology, and nobody knows anything about human behavior. Weather people are just strange. We are anomalies by nature. So the information that you're giving us will make us be so much better the next time this happens, whether it's an historic outbreak like April 27th or, you know, one tornado. It doesn't matter. This is good stuff. But for people that want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that? Email, Facebook, Twitter, website? What's the best way?
Email's the best way. And the email,
all right,
email address.
Do you dare give your email address out on this show?
I do. I will. Yeah, it's Dr. Laura Myers at gmail.com. DrLauraMyers at gmail.com.
And I can tell that Dr. Myers is really smart because everybody that's got a PhD that's been on the show, they have a massive printer behind them. And look at her shot right now. That thing is huge.
And by the way, if you look if over her other shoulder, if I'm not mistaken, there looks like a weather radio sitting there on the desk. Am I right?
That's right.
Wow.
I see what you did there.
Well, That's great. But again, Laura, thanks again so much for your work, and appreciate you spending an hour with us. And we hope to talk to you real soon. We'll for sure we'll be doing that here. But I hope you come back on the show real soon.
Well, thank
you
all for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. And what we are going to do right now is pause for Weather Brains 101. We've got This Week in Weather History. We'll take a look at the weather around the nation. Pattern change. Interesting days here as we get into April. Got the email segment, the fog bank, picks of the week, and much more as Weather Brains rolls along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
There is no doubt that the field of meteorology is filled with acronyms. Combine that with all of the abbreviations associated with aviation weather, and sometimes a weather forecast discussion can look like Campbell's alphabet soup. So here's another acronym you've probably run across. MOS, or M-O-S. Not to be confused with one of the 12,000 kinds of green plants that often grow in carpets in the woods. MOS stands for Model Output Statistics and refers to a technique used to objectively interpret numerical model output in order to produce site-specific guidance. Numerical weather forecast models, like the NAM or the GFS, are good at forecasting the evolving weather patterns, but they're really too broad to account for local variations that occur at the Earth's surface. But pure statistical models are very good at accounting for those local variations, but they become much less accurate with time. So the MOS technique essentially combines both elements along with climatology. It takes the complex numerical models that forecast the large-scale weather patterns and integrates that information using multilinear regression equations in statistical post-processing to arrive at site-specific details in the weather. And by the way, powerful computers generate MOS tables for the next 7 days for nearly 1,500 sites in the continental U.S. every 12 hours using millions of equations. Put that in your calculator. Now, believe it or not, this technique has been around nearly 50 years. It was pioneered in the 1960s and early 1970s by people like Glahn, Lowry, and Klein. MOS development work is done primarily by the Meteorological Development Lab, or MDL. Work to refine and improve MOS continues. So the next time you look out the window at the sky, and then to your computer screen displaying the MOS table for your locale, just think about how easy it is to get that max temperature value, but how much really went into arriving at that number. If you have a weather question, drop an email to question@weatherbrains.com.
On the morning of April 2nd, 1974, Mr. Robert Ferry, the meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Birmingham, received a call from Alan Pearson. He was the director of the National Severe Storms Forecast Center in Kansas City. Dr. Pearson started the call asking about the tornadoes that had popped through the state of Alabama the night before in sort of a cruel April Fool's joke. Two F2 tornadoes had produced some damage and one fatality. The first near Huntsville had resulted in the death. Another tornado had skipped across Blount County. It destroyed several mobile homes and a mobile home park near Aniana. Mr. Ferry said that things had been bad, but they could have certainly been a lot worse. Dr. Pearson told Mr. Ferry that if he thought the April Fool's Day weather was rough, just wait until the following day, Wednesday, April 3rd. It was already apparent to forecasters that a massive outbreak of severe weather was likely. A strong upper-level trough was located over the Great Basin of the western U.S. A broad surface low was already centered over Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. The central pressure was down to 991 millibars. This dynamic low-pressure system was poised to bring copious amounts of rich Gulf moisture northward. The Gulf had been basically open for business all spring, and the cold front that had moved through on April 1st did nothing to scour out the moisture out of the Gulf, so that was ready to come back to the north. Pearson was notifying the National Weather Service offices across the large area east of the Mississippi River that there would be a large tornado outbreak over the next 2 days. He asked that the field offices prepare for the potential severe weather by performing routine maintenance on their equipment and radars. He asked the meteorologists in charge to alert personnel that they might be called in to work extra hours or to work on their off day even. Preparations were made for the satellite to be operated in a severe weather mode the following day. And special balloon releases were set for midnight that night. Now, during the evening hours of April 2nd, tornado watches were posted across parts of Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. Severe weather reports were minimal from this opening round of weather from the powerful system. Forecasters knew trouble was brewing, but they had no idea how bad it would be. 148 tornadoes occurred in 24 hours across the eastern United States, including 30 violent tornadoes. 315 people were killed in 11 states, including 34 in the town of Xenia, Ohio alone, and over 80 in Alabama. Total damage, $500 million. The super outbreak of tornadoes was unprecedented in many categories, including total tornadoes, total path length at over 1,700 miles, and 30 violent tornadoes. That's a very important event that occurred during this week in weather history. Follow my weather history tweets on Twitter. I am WXHistorian at twitter.com.
Yeah, the super outbreak of 1974. I was a senior in high school. That is how old I am. And I spent 3 days volunteering after the event, helping with the communications effort. And that changed my life. I am a child of that event. So every year, come early April, I think back to that horrible, horrible day and night in 1974. But I tell you what, we're going to quickly just touch on weather around the nation. Again, this is on April Fool's Day, April 1st.
Imagine that, a podcast called Weather Brains talking about the weather.
Yes, just totally amazing.
James, would you like one of us to read JB's weather roundup? He sent it over an email, I noticed.
You know, I think he did.
You know, I'm the email officer. I should get to read it.
You should get to,
yeah,
man.
Go. Nate, you are now in charge of the National Weather Roundup.
Wow. So I was going to read it because it's already in the Weather Brains blog post.
Well, I'll defer to Brian.
No, I'll let you do it. Go ahead.
All right. Well, we have a pretty interesting pattern shift in effect. We had a cold March across most of the eastern third to half of the country for sure. But the last little while, we've had an amazing drop off in the number of winter weather advisories across the country that have been in effect. We still have a little bit of a lake effect snow up toward New York, but that's starting to drop off now as well. Freeze warning for a couple of counties in northeastern Tennessee. We made it to -2 in Minot, North Dakota, but we were hottest on Sunday in Laredo, Texas at 96. Still, I talked to a Dave Snyder up in Alaska. They finally started to see some cumulus clouds up that way, and he posted on his Facebook page, well, it's already, you know, spring. And I said, what the heck? It was just winter. It was 30 below. And it still is flirting with 30 below in parts of the interior of Alaska. But along the coast, they're starting to see some signs that spring is springing. Or this afternoon, made it to 85 in Phoenix with a relative humidity of a comfortably dry 11%. 85 in Abilene, Texas. 83 in Conley's neck of the woods. Correct me if I'm wrong on that number, Conley. 83 today. Does that sound right?
Yes, that's right.
All right. 84 in Tucson. And a big decline in coverage and snow cover. We're now down to under 35% across the country in terms of snow cover for this first day of April in the year of our Lord, 2013.
Don't forget the -3 at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota.
I mentioned that. Well, I got -2 yesterday, or was that today? Did I make it to -3?
Okay. That's -3 was today.
Okay.
You just well, blame right me. Over blame that town in Alaska there, Nate. How'd you do that?
Atkinsuk. I don't never not always right, but never in doubt.
And by the way, one note from Tom Skilling, the coldest White Sox home opener in 33 years.
I just
global warming.
And I just like to say they had snow showers today in advance of the Cubs opener in Pittsburgh today. The Cubs won 3-1. Next year is now, baby. That's all I'm going to say.
Go Cubs win. Cubs win. Cubs win.
Go Cubs.
Win. Cubs.
Oh
Cubs win.
Where are my pants?
All right. And next week, I think everybody's pretty much on this page that it looks like the first maybe big tornado outbreak of the year could be in the offing for next week. We get the 80s surging north up into the parts of the eastern half of the nation and a big trough sweeping in, your classic runner across the plains with snow back in the cold sector and severe weather and tornadoes in the warm sector. So we are definitely getting into spring. But let's roll on here because I look at the old clock on the wall, and before you know it, it's going to be that time. So Nate, my main man, is here with the email.
All right, get a video link from Michael W. Moss. There was a big 70, 90 some odd car pileup on I-77 in Carroll County, Virginia. This is northwest of Winston-Salem, Greensboro in North Carolina, just north of the North Carolina Virginia state line. This was bad, and this is a stretch of interstate. It's hilly. Over a course of something like 4 or 5 miles, there's a 1,600 foot elevation change, and so there's all kinds of fog potential up that way. And they had a really nasty crash over the weekend up that way. We'll post a link to that on the old WeatherBrains webpage. But I've driven that stretch of interstate. It is there aren't exactly a whole lot of places to get off the road up that way. So if you're stuck in a traffic jam, you're stuck. And if you have a two-year-old in the back seat, it just makes it that much more fun. I wouldn't know anything about that, though. All right. I have a few links from Tim Bryce from the National Weather Service. They had, by the way, some Weather Service social media training. And I saw some tweets from that, some good stuff coming. I know Rick Smith from the Weather Service office in Norman was tweeting some of that. A number of others were as well, so it's pretty good. Got a couple of links there. One social media front called Tag Board, so you can visualize your favorite hashtag. That could get interesting during severe weather. We have an Android app. This is cool. I'm surprised nobody lifted this for their pick of the week. An Android app that will allow you to measure hailstones without a ruler.
Ooh.
Yes. And totally unrelated to everything, it's an app called Listen to Bitcoin, or it's a website, sorry, and you can click on it and listen to all kinds of fun things that have nothing to do with weather, like wind chimes or stuff like that. So if you need to just unwind, you can go to that website and just tune out. It'll be good.
This group definitely needs to unwind.
Yes, and really? James is going to need to go to that, because the folks at that are behind the Dark Sky Weather app have released their own weather service. And I know comments as to whether or not this is a world-class weather organization like a certain agency based in Atlanta. But they've announced that they've created this website. It's called forecast.io, and it's built off the same back end that they have driving the Dark Sky app. And we know that James has a particular opinion about that. I think I know what Kevin's opinion is. They come to the same conclusion through different means, I guess. But interesting stuff. It's a slick front end. The question is whether or not the data behind it are any good. And that's something that we'll find out over the next little while. James, you look like you want to say something.
Well, let me just say this. The design is brilliant. The design is clean. It's brilliant. I love the design. And we could learn from that. But the information, it's another crap app. Every time I've looked at this thing, it's another crap app.
Wait, play the Kapuya thing again before we go on a rant.
I might have to do that.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
On that note,
that needs to be the official.
You punch this thing up, and it says, partly cloudy until evening. And then tomorrow it says partly cloudy throughout the day. Then Wednesday it says light rain until afternoon, starting again overnight. So this thing is saying it's going to rain in my market on Wednesday morning. If it rains here on Wednesday morning, I'm paying everybody on this show $100.
Oh, all right.
Nice.
All right.
Nice.
And if it's not raining, everybody on this show owes me $100.
But you're being
No. You're being scammed. I mean, it's beautiful, but it's just crap. It's the same automated stuff. Mm-hmm. They're pulling data from models and nobody's looking at it. There's no quality control. And I guarantee you, as we get into, summer when it's so hot, it's just going to be bad.
And it's interesting. And I wish I'd had a chance to bring this up with Chuck Doswell a couple weeks ago. But Dr. Doswell, Harold Brooks, and others told us this day would come. They told us the day would come, not in exactly as many words, but the day would come where the models would be, because of budget cuts or what have you, that we would get to the point where we would be relying more on the models for day-to-day weather, and that meteorologists would be in quality control or primarily communication, or therefore just days where you need to have severe weather or things like that, they black swan events, that sort of thing. It's really interesting to go back and read some of the stuff that they were writing and presenting at conferences 15 or 20 years ago, and then looking at what's happening in weather service offices and in television stations across the country today. It is scary prophetic. These guys were smart before smart was cool, and it's good stuff. Anyway, not to get completely off the boat here, but we haven't picked on the Weather Channel yet, so let's pick on them now. just kidding. I have good friends of the Weather Channel. Todd Foisey, the Weather Service office in Caribou, Maine, let us know that they're having a toughest Weather City tournament, sort of like a March Madness bracket thing. You see these this time of year, everything's a bracket. I don't know if you guys saw this, but there was a fast food bracket, like a Southern food bracket. And at one point, I saw Bojangles and Krispy Kreme were in the same bracket and all this other stuff, Crystal Burgers and the whole nine yards. See, the heart attack final four heartbeats. Anyway, Caribou, Maine is in the final four, I think. Let me see if I read this correctly. A final four taking on Fairbanks. So good stuff. If you want to head over to that other group and vote, you can. I'm not going to give them any more free press than I already have. Speaking of social media, this is interesting. Dan Goff, who is WX Dan on Twitter, although he's not Dan Goff anymore, but I'll let him explain. Anyway,
he changed his name.
I'll let you. I tried poking that bear, and he didn't want to talk. So,
okay,
I'll let you guys.
Kevin changed his name. It's not the first time it's happened. True.
So anyway, he is WX Dan on Twitter, and he says that he's browsing the website for the folks for a local Weather Service office in Virginia. He said that it used to be that he'd be able to find snow maps on the Weather Service website, but either on the new page nor on their old page. Of course, a lot of the local offices are changing the format of the front pages of the Weather Service websites. But said that the snow total map from this most recent event back in late March, he couldn't find it there, but he found it on their Facebook page. I thought that was interesting. Wow. That and didn't know if that was an oversight or if that was something, but very interesting. Is that something? Is that the direction we're going to go now, that the Weather Service is going to put things on Facebook and not on their own website?
I wondered that too, but I've noticed that sometimes, because the Weather Service here in Fort Worth puts things on their website, but I'm assuming it's some sort of automated timeout thing, because I have seen reference to something that's been on their site somewhere else or whatever and gone there to try and find it, but they don't seem to have any archive of that stuff, which I think would be really kind of helpful, but I think some of it maybe is some sort of auto-rotate to timeout or something like that.
But I wonder if that's what happened. Yeah, I don't know. And you know, it's depending on which office and who's managing their front page. Some of the offices have a really clean look, and some of them it's really hard to find stuff. And that left-hand panel on a lot of pages has gotten really cluttered to the point where if you don't know exactly what you're looking for and can't read the mind of the guy or gal who put it there, you're never going to find it. But,
wow, Nate, I have to make a comment.
Oh,
I can't let this go by.
Bring it.
Oh, this is good. This is good. Go. He's getting cranky.
I'm not getting cranky.
He's been cranky.
I just hope that none of the Weather Service management is listening, because when I left, when I retired from the Weather Service, one of their expressed goals was to make every single web page across the country identical. They're not going to like what you said.
Don't kill the messenger. I'm just, you know, it is what it is. So anyway,
is life insurance paid up?
Yes. just you know, at least give me until tomorrow afternoon to get my wife and daughter home from the airport, and then, you know. Anyway,
that's all right. National Weather Service headquarters can't get their act together anyway, so who cares?
Is that what you're doing in your new company, Brian? Going around enforcing Weather Service rules?
All right, two last things, and then I know James has to play audio clip here, but I wanted to pass along Daniel Lucas. There's the feedback that he provided that I provided on the show last week. Well, he's feedbacking the feedback. He's clarifying that a little bit, that the kerfuffle about naming tropical storms was in 1970, not 1952. And the underworn circumstance, he's got a link to the Valley WX plug, which I think one of the guys in Huntsville has something to do with. So that's that. Finally, our correspondent from Eastern Europe, Tarmul Tanelsu, has sent us an update. James, would you do the honors?
Yes, this is our European reporter.
Hello, Weather Brains. This is Tarmo Danilso, a self-proclaimed chief international crank, checking in. Yes, I can be pretty cranky. First off, a note to Kevin.
a lot of weather stuff, cool weather stuff going on in Copenhagen. We need to open a Copenhagen branch. We need to get Tarmo, go over and do some reporting from Copenhagen. That can't be too far away.
Sorry, Kevin. Copenhagen is a 22-hour drive away. Not affordable and not gonna happen. That said, I have some questions myself about that thing. Some quick notes. Spring is still AWOL just today. We had snow, and in fact, I heard a few reports on the radio about snow-related disruptions in Poland. In southeastern Europe, there is severe weather. A tornado was reported in northern Serbia on Sunday, as well as some hail up to around an inch. Thunderstorms have been taking place today as well, particularly in Turkey and Ukraine. And as I'm recording this on Monday evening, my time, there appears to be something up in Tunisia as well. Also, some updates about proposed and rushed merger of Estonian Meteorological and Hydrological Institute, our weather service, with some other organizations. Some confusing signals coming over the past few weeks. Last week, the Maalehti, a weekly newspaper here, seemed to give some hope that perhaps brakes could be slammed on the plans. Today, there was a report in our public broadcaster that the plan still is on and the new joint organization will be founded officially before 1st of July. Note, initial rumblings talked about 1st of May. I guess we'll see. Meteorologists and climatologists, as well as the Estonian Fund for Nature, have spoken out against it. But last week, the Nature Protection Commission of Estonian Academy of Sciences had a meeting, and despite numerous questions and discussion that lasted hours, they decided they won't be working against it publicly. A few weeks ago, I was at a World Meteorological Day conference in Tallinn, and at least three presenters made at least veiled remarks about the proposed merger. Some were even pretty frank. Nonetheless, it's going to be a wild year over here. I have gotten an impression that there are people who think that, let's say, observing weather is no different from counting birds in a forest. P.S. If you see a lot of blue tomorrow, it is World Autism Awareness Day, a day that me, who has Asperger's, well, let's say it's hard for me to forget it. All right, this has been Chief International Crank, Tarmo Danilso, reporting from Estonia. Have a great evening.
And that is all for the email weather inbox today. If you want to hear your stuff here on the email, send us an email at weatherbrains.com. You can tweet us at weatherbrains. You can find us on Facebook or on the Google Plus, and tell us how we're doing. Go to weatherbrains.com and fill out a listener survey response. I was disappointed in Weatherbrains Nation this week. I didn't get any listener survey responses. I expect that to be fixed by next week. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Now, hang on. Let me get that screen share off here. I've got to go television here in a minute. But I tell you what, before we and I got a rant. Goodness, I am livid.
Bring it. Play the Kapuya.
Well, I need to, but you know, I don't have time to get into this. But you know, television stations have now been mandated by the Federal Communications Commission on their live stream on the internet to put closed captioning on there. So that has hosed up all the live streams. You got all these live streams that the closed captioning takes up like half the screen. You can't see anything. It's forced a lot of these horrible changes. What jurisdiction does the FCC have over some live internet stream? Are they going to require us to closed caption this show? I mean, so it is really boogered up, yeah. Boogered up the whole situation here. But I don't have time to go into the rest of this tirade. But having said that, let's run
the closed captioning officer.
Oh, yeah, really. There you go.
Thanks.
Let's roll the fog bank.
Hello, Weather Brains listeners. This is Dave Phillips with the fog bank for April 1st. No fooling. I'm back. I'll have all of these links up on my blog, skydaver.blogspot.com, and any other fog banks that I've missed. First up, from the Capital Weather Gang, got a blog post on Confessions of a Weather Weenie. At the time they put this post up, they were asking for our stories, too. My next pick comes from Coco Roz. Their message today, back on March 12th, they had a short discussion of Coco Roz and the NSSL's Ping project and how they went along together, not competitive. NOAA Weather Partners has a new video from the National Severe Storms Lab about radar research. The astronomy picture of the day from March 26th had a fantastic aurora photo. My final pick comes from a Twitter user called Science Porn. I've looked at their postings, and I'm sure they're safe for work or to show your grandma. This photo is allegedly sunrise at the North Pole with a new moon. I'm not certain if the photo hasn't been manipulated, but it is absolutely beautiful regardless. I think you'll like it. Thanks for listening. Skydiver out.
Yeah, I've seen that picture, and it's a fake, but to me, it's a great piece of art. All right, let me do my pick here, and then you guys can take over. This is actually a little bit of breaking news. I mean, I guess we need to. We got to roll that open here. Hang on.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert bulletin.
James Hansen has resigned his post at NASA. After nearly a half century of research in planetary and climate science for NASA, James Hansen is retiring Wednesday to pursue his passion for climate activism. And I don't want to go any more than that, but I found that very interesting. How many times has he been arrested now?
Does it say how he's going to monetize this pursuit?
That's a very interesting question, and I'm not going to get in trouble.
I'm leaving.
I don't want to be involved in this.
Oh, you got to hear this. You got to hear this.
Go.
He's going to sell used sirens.
What? All right, Kevin, the floor is yours. I'm retiring to the television side.
Great. James drops a climate bomb and then runs. That's fantastic. All right, well, let's do picks of the week. Let's go down the line. Bill, are you talking to James, or are you going to do a pick of the week?
No, I've got my pick of the week. It's
all right.
In honor of Chuck Doswell, who was on the show a few weeks ago, and the Electronic Journal of Severe Storms Meteorology, his paper, with several other authors, including Robert Maddox and a bunch of others, John Hart, Stephen Pilts, and Don Burgess, was published today in the Electronic Journal of Severe Storms Meteorology, the analysis of the tri-state event, March 1925. And, you always question whether that tornado is actually on the ground for 219 miles as a continuous track. And it was on the ground for 219 miles, according to their analysis. And just a perfect juxtapositioning of everything. The, very strong surface low, a warm front that was moving north rapidly, and a dry line, just the perfect set of conditions to produce the supercell that, raced out to the east. And produced this tornado that was on the ground for 3 hours. It's pretty fascinating reading. And you've got the link there, Brian. It'll be on the weatherbrains.com website.
Fantastic. Thank you, sir. Brian Peters, how about a pick of the week?
Yes. Well, after my comment about used sirens, I'm going to pick some software written by a friend of mine called Weather Message. I think I've used this one a few years ago, but in light of all the discussion about sirens, this is wonderful because it actually allows activation.
Yay.
Yes. So, I mean, I think sirens are part of the warning system, but I agree with James that people who are indoors, and I have a siren like a mile from me, and I can't hear it. So I think you need to realize that it's very unlikely, if it's not on your doorstep, that you probably won't be able to hear it if you're indoors, especially if the wind is blowing. So you got to keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm much more in favor of these weather apps on your smartphones. And I know everybody doesn't have a smartphone, but it might be a good reason to get a smartphone to keep you informed.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that, and Dr. Myers mentioned it, that the work that I've done in sort of digging through all of the post-event surveys and interviews that have been done, it's the damnedest thing. It's, you'll find in the same study, and study after study after study says that people, either the number one or number two way that people got the warning initially was sirens. And it was key to their decision-making process, and yet it was also one of the number one or number two sources of confusion in the entire process. It's the kind of thing where you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah. Well, I think what bothers me about sirens more than anything else is, after a big event, we have a tendency to throw thousands and thousands of dollars because it looks like we're doing something, when in reality, we really aren't. And that thousands and thousands of dollars is going to result in budgets for thousands and thousands of dollars more, because weather sirens are notoriously maintenance hogs. Mm-hmm. They require, I mean, first of all, you got to pay the electric bill to the sites, yeah, or the and the radio equipment, and then you've got maintenance of all that stuff, and it sits out in the weather. You know, I mean, it's a money pit.
Birds.
Do what?
And birds.
Yeah, birds.
Birds and those things. And
birds and bugs and all ants.
Birds,
and
birds, yeah, that fly.
Squirrels. I mean, squirrels. Jeez. Okay, so I'm off my rant about science. Anyway, Danny Lloyd's weather message software is fantastic, and anybody who's in the siren sounding business needs to consider that because it would be very effective.
So this is a product not for the general public, but for people who operate sirens?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I would say it's not for the general public. I mean, you
okay,
know.
Unless the general public wants to set up their own sirens, then yes, you can you master your own domain.
I'm not going there.
All right, thanks, Brian. Conley, you got a pick of the week for us?
I do. First of all, I just want to say thanks for having me on the show.
Well, sure. We're gonna talk about Waco here in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, sure. I wanted to share something from tonight. I'm actually a contributor for a website called TexasStormChasers.com. There's a group of four of us led by David Reimer. We all have Ginny, who's a photographer. I'm a contributor as well. We have storm chaser David Drummond. And hopefully you can see this picture. Can you see it?
Yep.
The tornado.
Yep. Purdy.
Yeah, that was earlier this evening in Silverton, David was lucky enough. He got right onto that storm and was able to capture this. It had a touchdown right behind him. It only lasted for about 5 minutes. Did blow a tin barn. That was about all that was out there. So luckily, it didn't cause any damage. But the Texas Storm Chaser site that I work for has a huge social media presence. And so it's a great site if you're wanting, you know, during severe weather to be able to see pictures, videos. They have a huge following, over 120,000 Facebook likes and over 30,000 Twitter followers. So it's amazing to see the kind of reach that social media has with these guys, and they cover the whole state, which is a big task, but it's today is a great example of the work that they do. You know, they were one of the few chasers to capture it.
What's the URL then for that site? What is the URL for that site?
Texas Storm Chasers. TexasStormChasers.com.
All right, very good.
It's already up there.
My pick of the week is mostly a picture. It's from the Capital Weather Gang, and it's just kind of a fun picture that they posted from one of their users, I don't know, a week or so ago, from snow in the D.C. area. And the snow, big sheet of snow, had slid down a slide in a playground and sort of crumpled into an interesting little pile. But we'll have the link there at weatherbrains.com. And a shout out to Capital Weather Gang, Nate, right? Jason Samanow, mm-hmm, wrote a review of the dark sky forecast tool that you were talking about a few minutes ago, forecast.io, and was either kind enough or foolish enough to ask our opinions for that article. And so we thank him for you know, including us in that. The headline of that story, I guess we can, I'll send it to you as well, Brian. It's called Review of Dark Sky's New Forecast Tool, Forecast.io, at the Capital Weather Gang site.
By the way, Kevin.
Yes.
I was looking at that site when James was describing it as, you know, not so kind.
Yes.
It's very interesting that for my location, it says there'll be no rain on Saturday. However, the map shows it raining on Saturday.
Oh, break in consistency there.
So it's kind of like, oops.
I hate it when that happens.
Me too. Nate, how about a pick of the week?
I have two.
All right.
Because I wasn't here last. Well, I wasn't here last week, so I got to, you know, it's like makeup homework, you know, you gotta make it up. Anyway, from last week, forecast.io, and I'm picking that for last week because they didn't announce it until after the show, and so I want to seem sort of, you know, omniscient about that. So anyway, the forecast announcement from Dark Sky. And then today, April 1st, 2013, what happened? I'm surprised, Bill, you didn't mention this. 53 years ago today, something fundamental.
Yes, I know.
Anybody but Brian. No, I'm just kidding. The first, we got the first satellite, yes, from Tyros 1.
Yes.
The television spread, Tyros, whatever. It was a satellite. We shot it up into space, and it sent back pictures of our clouds, and it was awesome.
and amazing pictures considering what we have today.
No kidding. Well, and amazing considering what we had to work with. I mean, you figure on the timelines that these things were going on. This was before, or not very long after Kennedy's announcement that we were going to try and put a man on the moon by the end of the decade and all that kind of stuff. But this is, you know, for 1950s technology, we shot something up there. It held together and it sent back pictures. And you want to talk about
for 2.5 months?
No kidding.
But you want to talk about something that has fundamentally changed? I mean, you think about the your television broadcasting meteorologist. What would we do if we didn't have satellite pictures?
Heaven forbid.
Oh,
we'd have to look out the window.
No, not that. Anything but that. I'd have to go outside.
You know, that's funny. I was going to ask this question one day of the group, but the question was going to be, you've been off for a couple of days. You come back in the office. What's the very first thing that you look at? It can be model data or it can be radar or whatever it is. But my answer was going to be the first thing I do when I sit down in this office every day, because I come in the afternoon, is the visible satellite picture.
Absolutely.
Would you do that too?
First thing I do is I go on the way in from the car. I spend a little more time walking in than I normally would. Because especially
data point that you look at then?
Well, I mean, I look up. I mean,
as you sit down in the office,
the point, I'm not answering your question, because the point is we had the founding fathers of this country who were logging weather and able to predict 24-hour weather patterns with the kind of accuracy that we can only dream of. Yeah. Not really, but they were pretty insightful, and we can learn a lot. And I tell when I go to talk to school kids, you can really learn a lot about near-term weather just by looking very closely at the clouds from day to day. But once I get in the office, visible satellite, radar, and a surface plot.
Bill, first data point, Bill.
Well, you know, I've got 4 screens in my office, so I'm kind of cheating a little bit, you know, because you've got 3 satellite pictures, Kevin. You know, you've got a water vapor with a 500 millibar over it, you know, a national surface.
You're using semi-wave whips, aren't you?
Yeah, laying over, you know, an infrared satellite and then drilling down on the right to, you know, close over Alabama, visible satellite with the, you know, surface plots over it. You know, so it is the common element. There's the satellite.
Yeah. Conley, what about you?
You may not like this answer, but the first thing I like to look at is the MOS data compared to what the forecaster before me and the prior shift said. So I can find the trends of what the data is doing, whether MOS is going up or down. I mean, it's only a small part of my complete forecast. And then from there, I'll look at like a surface map or something like that. But I like to look at the raw numbers and the data.
Good. Nate, did you finish? You said you had 2. Did you finish both of them?
I did. Yeah, the forecast was last week, and then Tyrus 1 was this week. The television infrared observing satellite.
Conley, tell us about Waco. What is the number one forecast challenge in Waco, Texas?
All that crappy weather those Abilinians send your way every night at 3 in the morning.
Yes, very much so. No, we cover such a large area. You know, our television market isn't just one big city. We have Waco, Temple, Killeen, and Killeen has Fort Hood, one of the largest military bases in the country. And we also cover Bryan College Station, and that's where I went to school, is Texas A&M. So down there, you know, it's hard to associate Bryan College Station with Waco Temple. They're over 90 miles apart from each other, but yet our forecast, our 7-day, is supposed to represent everybody, and it only represents really Waco, Temple, Killeen. And so that's probably one of the biggest challenges we have, because in severe weather, you know, we're covering them in severe weather, which makes our severe weather events last twice as long because we cover such a huge area.
And that is a very interesting. Let's see, Kevin, are you talking?
I'm sorry, I had made a noise and muted myself. I was on the keyboard for a second. Tell us the social media presence at the station.
Unfortunately, whenever I've been here for about 5 years, and when I first started, we had almost zero presence in social media, and that was only 5 years ago. So we were behind the ball. And I helped create the weather Twitter account and the weather Facebook account. And then after about a year of doing that, we got a couple thousand followers, and our management was like, oh, hey, maybe we need to go do this. And then so they created the news, you know, side of the social media. And now, you know, they include Facebook in their 5 o'clock newscast. They ask, what's the favorite story you want to talk about? And then at 6 o'clock, you know, they read Facebook responses. But we're a little bit behind the times as far as adapting to that. This area is also very weird because Waco has a lot of technology smart people and has a good social media presence. But then you go to Temple, Killeen, and especially with Fort Hood, you have soldiers and families coming and going. You know, they only stay for a year or two and then they leave. And so a lot of people don't know we're there or unaware we're there. And there's not a big social media kind of presence around Fort Hood or Killeen. So, you know, we're probably behind the ball compared to a lot of TV stations, but, you know, we're trying to catch up.
Well, now that you've thrown management under the bus, tell everybody tell everybody how we can find you online or anywhere you want to send it.
And if they have a job, they can send your way. Cause, you know.
No, I'm not too worried. Yeah, as far as our website, kxxv.com, and I'm on Twitter. I'm a big follower on Twitter. There are some days I prefer Twitter over Facebook. Facebook is kind of my personal keeping up with friends from college and high school, but Twitter is amazing. The amount of news, breaking weather. Twitter is it's just amazing the information you can find. So I'm pretty heavy in my activity on Twitter. It's just my name spelled out, Conley Isom. Conley Isom. That's my screen name on Twitter. And so I prefer Twitter nowadays over Facebook just because of all the problems and restrictions Facebook has now.
Yeah, very good. Bill, how about upcoming programs? Thanks for getting Laura on, by the way. I really enjoyed that.
Well, she's wonderful. It's always nice to talk to her. The fellow who wrote the Storm Kings book, Lee Hadley, will be on next week.
Ooh.
And I don't think I have. I just closed my other computer, so I don't have the other guests that are coming up. But he's he's up next and on deck here on opening day for Major League Baseball.
Well, Bill doesn't get enough credit for being the guest booking officer. That's a especially now that we've added the Google Plus part of it, because I've done that a few times where you have to get the people on, and that is a to put it kindly, it's a beating.
And even when it works in the test, sometimes it doesn't work. Yeah. At the time,
we've been in touch with some of the Google Plus people, and they're aware. You know, I've asked for a big giant flashing button, you know, that flashes in the middle of the screen when you've been invited to a hangout, and they're aware of that. So they have a lot of things to do when you're building an international platform, and we'll see how those things come along. Anybody else got any news before we wrap it up? I don't think James is back, is he? No.
Nope. No, not yet.
I was gonna say real quick, in 2 or 3 weeks is the Tropical Weather Conference. It's the first annual Tropical Weather Conference in South Padre Island in South Texas. They're going to have a lot of other tropical experts there talking about past hurricane season, talking about social media. I've been lucky enough to be asked to present on social media and how it's used to portray severe weather information specifically towards tropical systems. So coming up in about 3 weeks, there's going to be a live stream from what I've told. The live stream will be able to watch, I think, for free, and we'll be out there. I believe the dates are April 18th through the 20th. I believe April 18th through the 20th.
And is there a website where people could track that or find it?
HurricaneCenterLive.com. HurricaneCenterLive.com, I believe, is the website.
Fantastic. Well, Conley, thanks for joining us this week. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I look forward to being on again.
Very good. Well, we do this program every Monday night. We are back on Monday night schedules now. It's live at 8:30 Central Time, and you can catch the live program at live@bigbrainsmedia.com. Afterwards, you can find it on YouTube, on the WeatherBrains account. You can find it at weatherbrains.com, where all our social media contacts are there as well. We'd love to hear from you. The email, what's the email, officer?
email@weatherbrains.com.
And send the listener surveys, because apparently that makes Nate grumpy if we don't get at least one of those every week. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good place to stop the show. All right. Find us at weatherbrains.com every Monday night at 8:30. We thank you for joining us. Have a great week and God bless. Oh, and I am not James Spann.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah for that. All right, guys. Any other news? Brian, you going to tell us more about the book?
No.
Das Buch.
All right.
It's going to be interesting to see if we get any feedback on that. I would like to see feedback.
What are you asking?
None yet.
What are you asking for?
Well, I mean, you know, whether people think they might be interested in it or not.
All right. So if you're interested, let Brian know.
Send the notes to kevin.selly at something, something, dot something.
Well, how am I all of a sudden your PR guy?
Oh. Well, you planted the seed. I figured. Oh,
yeah. All right. That's
Farmer
fine.
Kevin.
All right.
All right. Well, see good guys. Show, guys. Thanks a lot. See you next week.
All right.
See you. Y'all take care.
Bye.
Bye.